AUK 540 AM Jackson, W266 DR Waukesha, and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper in Chicago. A busy day on the campaign trail this Labor Day. President Biden honored American workers and touted his economic record at a union event in Philadelphia. He repeatedly threw jabs at former President Trump, the leading GOP presidential candidate, without mentioning him by name.
We've recovered all the jobs lost during the pandemic. We've added millions more. People are coming off the sidelines to go to work. More than 700,000 people joined the labor force last month.
GOP candidate and former VP Mike Pence in New Hampshire took aim at the president.
Yeah, I'm running for president because I think this country's in a lot of trouble. I really do. I think Joe Biden has weakened this country at home and abroad.
Republican Vivek Ramaswamy, also in New Hampshire, told voters,
"We can't just criticize the so-called radical Biden agenda. Of course, there's everything in the world wrong with it. But that's not enough. That's why I think that's actually why we didn't succeed in 2022.
The mass exodus is underway as partygoers head home from this year's waterlogged Burning Man event in the Nevada desert. KTVN-TV's Emily Benito has more from northern Nevada.
Trying to dig an RV out of the mud is no easy task.
But this morning we were digging, we were on our hands and knees, like digging mud out of our tires.
Even if they can make it out of the mud, burners aren't out of the woods yet. The rain also causing puddles of water on the road. The rain is only adding more difficulty to an already stressful travel day. But even through all of the difficulties of the week, burners say that it was worth it.
Oh, I mean, it's still a great event. I love it, and I'm definitely going back next year.
Millions of Americans are hitting the roads and skies as the Labor Day weekend wraps up. CBS's Major Garrett.
The TSA expects to screen more than 14 million passengers through the six-day stretch that ends Wednesday. AAA says international bookings were up 44%. Domestic bookings up 4%.
Pennsylvania police are searching for Danilo Cavalcante, who was sentenced to life without parole last week for first-degree murder but escaped from a Chester County prison Thursday. KYW-TV's Marcella Baeto reports.
Danilo Cavalcante was spotted on a residential surveillance camera this weekend, less than 2 miles from where he escaped.
People are working round the clock.
Police are blaring a recorded message from Cavalcante's mother, urging him to surrender. They have narrowed their search to a residential area that's deep in the woods, closing off roads to limit access in or out. Police say they have responded to well over 100 tips from neighbors in the area. Since his escape from the Chester County prison on Thursday morning, Cavalcante has been spotted 4 times in this area outside of Philadelphia.
This is CBS News.
You need to hire fast and hire right? You need Indeed. Their all-in-one hiring platform helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates efficiently. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
Your home for local news, weather, and sports across the airwaves and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Here's what you need to know. Some communities around Wisconsin are getting vending machines with fentanyl test strips and Narcan. 15 local governments are getting grants for the vending machines from the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Narcan can reverse the effects of an opioid overdose. Forward Analytics says fentanyl is the leading cause of death in Wisconsin for people aged 25 to 54. Wisconsin wildlife officials are looking for whoever shot and killed 3 trumpeter swans and a great blue heron in northeast Wisconsin last week. The rare birds are protected species. Department of Natural Resources wardens say it happened in the Navarino Wildlife Area near Clintonville. The sentence for killing a protected species in Wisconsin is up to 9 months in jail, $5,000 in fines, and a 3-year ban on hunting. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
The Todd Alba Show.
I see the silhouette of Todd Alba, who still hasn't figured out that maybe a TV person could help, you know, set this whole thing up.
For whatever reason, yeah. StreamYard's video is just deciding that the room is too bright.
When has Todd Alba been accused of being too bright? I mean, really there. I'm like, where's Aaron with the rim shot?
The Todd Alba Show. Weekday afternoons from 1 till 3 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
If you love them enough to listen to them practice the same song on tuba.
Please be done.
Over and over and over and over and over. Then surely you'll check nhtsa.gov/the right seat to make sure they're correctly buckled in the back seat.
Sounds good, honey.
Check today at nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
People won't give you the real talk on drugs, but it's time we know the facts. Fentanyl is killing people. It's a powerful opioid, often made illegally and commonly mixed with illicit drugs. It can even be pressed into counterfeit pills that resemble prescription medications. Just 2 milligrams, about the size of a few grains of sand, can potentially be lethal. This isn't an ad to scare you, but it is an ad to make you think twice. Get the facts. Go to realdealonfentanyl.com. This message is brought to you by the Ad Council.
The Civic Media Network of radio stations across Wisconsin. We are your hometown radio, refreshed.
By 2024.
I know, so we're going to have to buy new chargers to meet those standards.
And finally, New York Governor Kathy Hochul announced that her state is following California's lead in phasing out polluting internal combustion engine cars. New York will ban the sale of new gasoline and diesel cars by 2035, although auto industry analysts see some signs that the inflection point for electric cars versus gas cars may come much, much sooner.
Very cool. And thank you for copying us, New York. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com.
Are you tired of think tank approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute. This is the best of the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So back here at Baker's Lounge in Hamtramck, Michigan. Yes, I'm actually in Michigan. a kid growing up in Cleveland, this is one of those places, you know, it's almost like not quite Pittsburgh, but it's on that list. Everyone we've met here, fantastic. And in fact, I'm sitting here with one of my favorite people in Congress, Representative Andy Levin. Andy, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, Rick, it's great to have you in Michigan. Welcome to Hamtramck, brother.
Yeah, I got to tell you, we drove into Michigan, and I'm kind of like, a little uneasy. But everyone here, fabulous.
Yeah, no, we love our ribbing with our friends from Ohio or Pennsylvania or whatever, but it's, you know, there's a feeling about the Midwest that, you know, of hospitality and down to earthness and welcoming and taking care of each other.
Because I think the reason is it's the communities are so similar. We mm-hmm. just came out of Erie. You know, I grew up in Cleveland. It could have been the same thing. They were identical.
Yeah. And I mean, oh my God, the history of this little town, you know, Hamtramck. I mean, it's just amazing. It's within the city of Detroit, really. And it was a real Polish enclave, and now it's diverse beyond belief. It's the first place in America, I think, to have a majority Muslim city council. And it's got a lot of incredibly rich culture of people from around the world. So it's an amazing American place. We're sitting here right here in this car.
The story, I mean, you know, and part of what we're doing on this tour is talking about places like this that at one point were, the high point of middle class living, of yeah. you know, working class prosperity, and then whatever reason things got really bad, and now things are starting to arc their way up, and regardless of who's living here, things are getting better.
Things are getting better, and one of the it's just astounding to watch like what's happening in America. All of my colleagues in Congress and on the Democratic side are saying, you know, we have to make it in America, you know, reshore, onshore, all bring manufacturing job back. And I'm thinking, dang, A lot of y'all voted for every stupid trade agreement that ever. I'm talking about Democrats, not Republicans. Yeah, yeah. I mean, the Republicans have always been horrible on trade. But, you know, a lot of my dear friends in the Democratic Party voted for NAFTA. They voted for every trade agreement. And now they're like, wait a minute. We have supply chain issues. I'm like, hello.
Yeah, welcome to the club.
Yeah.
Thanks for being here.
All our jobs are in China. Hello. You know.
Where
anyway,
you been?
Right. So
no, this is where, you know, this is part of what we're doing. You know, the reality is we've got to have these conversations. You got to talk to people and explain them. Look, you know, we made some mistakes. And I argue that, you know, you go back to deregulation. You know, deregulation, Democrats did that too.
Right.
And Republicans
Airlines,
used it.
Trucking.
Absolutely.
It was a big mistake.
And the same thing, I come back to this point that Democrats believed that they were doing the right thing, that they were going to help people, they were going to move things forward. Republicans knew what they were doing. They knew yeah. this was going to crush the working class and consolidate wealth. There's a difference in motive, I believe.
No question.
Or am I wrong?
No, you're right. But also, I mean, Democrats are, if you look at, you know, everybody talks about bipartisanship, and I actually do a lot of bipartisan legislating in Congress, but if you ask a Democrat, well, why are you Democrat? What are you proud of? Or what has the Democratic Party accomplished? They're going to talk about things that we did in the 1930s, in the 1960s, that are definitional of the Democratic Party and of justice in America.
Yep.
And it was all accomplished with huge majorities of Democrats in the House and the Senate under LBJ, back under FDR. And we need to, you know, I'll do bipartisan, basically the, you know, when we got Republicans in there, I'll work with them. But we need to build huge Democratic majorities and transform this country so that the working class can breathe and live the American dream again. And that's what I'm my.
But you got to go back there
about.
And you got to be talking to working people. The sad
yeah,
reality is most
exactly.
working people don't believe that Democrats are the party of working people anymore. Now, I understand, and I say this all the time, that Republicans hate working people. Just look at their policies.
Yeah.
And that comes out in everything they do. But Democrats haven't really been the champion for a while.
Well, or that's the, yeah, and there's this whole thing about style. You know, like, the Democrats are like the coastal elites or the wine swilling, this. I mean, whatever. Here's the thing. Who's going to butter your bread? Who's going to give you living wages? Who's going to recognize your freedom to form unions and bargain collectively? Who's going to get health care for everybody? Who's going to control the price of prescription drugs? And the Republicans aren't going to do any of that. So you're right. We have to marry the progressive policy and the working class policy with actually getting out there and talking to working class people, being amongst them. How about getting more of them to run for office and having, you know, more working people in the House, in the Senate, you know, in the state legislatures. I mean, that's another whole angle that's very important.
I would love to have more Democrats and more Republicans and more people in the halls of power who know how to change a tire.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, the sad reality, I think that should be a test.
It used to be change your oil. Now almost nobody does. We all changed our oil around here when we were kids. I
mean, absolutely.
Still do. Yeah, but
now
people, I mean, the cars are just so complicated and computerized that people are scared to do their basic maintenance. But in my car, you know, I drove here in a Chevy Bolt. It doesn't have oil. There's no oil to change.
I'm waiting to be rich enough to be able to afford a
the Bolt's pretty gear. Good. I mean, when the $7,500 credit was there for GM, you know, it was near the average price of a car. So now we've legislated to bring back the incentives to buy electric cars. But
so how come nobody knows that? Why aren't we telling that story?
Well,
because all I keep hearing is I wish I could be rich like those latte drinking, Volvo driving liberals that you
exactly,
hang around with. Rick.
Exactly.
So why don't we hear enough of that?
I don't know. You know, one of my favorite bills, for example, that I've been championing in Congress is the Got Truckers Act, the Guaranteed Overtime for Truckers Act. And it's the shortest bill I ever wrote. It basically, do you know, I mean, I don't know if your listeners, viewers know, that long-haul truck drivers don't get overtime. And back in the 30s, when the Fair Labor Standards Act was passed, they figured, well, you know, we don't want, it's logical, but also backwards. We don't want truck drivers to drive super long hours, so that's not safe. So therefore, don't give them overtime. Well, Except what you're doing just there is you just gave the boss an incentive to work them super long because they're not going to make overtime. And you're guaranteeing people having – so the working conditions are miserable for truckers, whether they're an employee trucker, a Teamster member, or whether they're an independent operator. You know, they're and the industry's created all these schemes and tricks, you know. Oh, you're all the time that you're waiting for the equipment to be the cartage to be loaded on your truck, you're not paid. That's, you know, you're waiting, you're not driving, you're paid by the mile, you're not doing a mile. I mean, what normal person wouldn't say you're at work? You just drove 900 miles. You're sitting at a steel mill waiting for steel coil to be loaded on your truck. I don't think you're taking care of your kids. I don't think you're going out to dinner with your wife. You were at blanking work right there.
No,
and you're not being paid for it.
I know you know. I've been a truck driver for over 30 years.
Yeah.
All this stuff is stuff I talk about. And I think your bill was fantastic. What I think you put
Did
people
you hear we got a Senate companion? That just happened.
Get out.
Yeah, we got a Senate companion bill. I swear, I don't think it'll pass while I'm here, you know, because this is my last term. But I think eventually we'll pass this bill because it's just such common sense to let – so if you let truck drivers make overtime, then you're raising your wages for truckers. You'll have less turnover. It'll be a better job. You'll have more safety because – most accidents involving truckers are with rookie drivers, you know, first-year drivers. So if you'll have more veteran drivers, it'll be safer. And the industry will actually benefit despite themselves because they'll have to rationalize it. They, you know, and instead of trying to force, you know, they're like, oh, well, why should I hire three people, you know, to do 120 hours? I'll just have two people. Therefore, I save a whole pension, you know, whatever. I save the employer taxes. I save whatever I give on healthcare. But that is not a good way to run a business.
No, but the other side of this is, and we talk about supply chain shortages, and, you know, the ports were all jammed up, and
exactly.
There were truck drivers that were waiting there, just sitting.
Yes.
And if you would have had somebody whose responsibility is to make sure that they were utilized properly, we hear about trucker driver shortages all the time. There's not a shortage. There's just a misappropriation and misuse of people's time and energy because just what you said.
If you have to pay for the time.
You have to pay for them sitting there?
Yeah. Hello. You're going to make it work efficiently. And
exactly.
You know.
And this is where I think this is where legislation like that has to come out. Because I know my truck driver buddies, they're all, you know, ratchet jaw Trump supporters.
I know. This is that's why I've had so much fun with this. Because this legislation has put me on these trucker shows and everything. And I've had the best time. They have call-ins. You know, I talk to these truck drivers. And I'm like, I don't care what party you are. You deserve to make a living wage. You deserve to, you know,
even
not
if
have
you
to
don't
work
want to. And this is what I do when I was doing organizing with the Teamsters. This is what I used to tell them. I would show them my paycheck. I'd say, here, you don't even have to show me yours. This is what I make for my $50 a month. And I wish I could get the kind of return on investment that I get for my union dues that I get in my paycheck that you're not getting. Because unlike you, I get paid for my waiting time. I get paid for breakdown time. I get paid for dropping hooks. I get paid for all of that stuff.
Yeah.
Because I'm part of a union. And this is where. You, I love your bill, but I still say you should be joining a union.
Oh, 100%. And the Teamsters are the union's a big supporter of this bill. But, you know, we've got a massively organized all truckers and every other works. Guess what happened today? This is a news flash.
Sure.
The latest Starbucks to form a union was the one by my house. Right out here by my house. They voted 9-2 or something.
Nice.
So another Starbucks unionizing with Workers United. And,
good,
you know, that company is using every union busting trick in the book to try to, you know, they're giving all these benefits to only the non-union stores. They're
Which is a violation.
Violation. They're dragging everything out. But, you know, ultimately, we have to help workers organize across the map. And that organizing has to drive to force Congress, to the Senate, to join the House, and finally passing labor law reform. And that'll unleash a whole much, 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 much bigger wave of organizing like happened in the 30s and 40s.
No, and hopefully we get a couple more senators like we see. Like last night we were in Erie and we saw, you know, Senator Casey and Senator Sherrod Brown, you know,
champions of workers.
Pitching for John Fetterman. They're also out there, you know, pitching for Tim Ryan. It'd be great to see two more Democrats in the Senate.
We get Tim and Fetterman. We're going to, you know, keep the Senate and maybe grow things. Yeah.
We could maybe get some things done and maybe return reward back to work. Because, you know, the sad reality is you brought up Starbucks. And I get it thrown back at me all the time. Well, Democrats are just as bad as Republicans on labor, because Howard Schultz was probably going to be Secretary of Labor had Hillary Clinton won.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, let that steam around in your head for a second.
I'm letting it pass right by, Rick. I don't even want to think about that. Look, we got Marty Walsh right now.
Love
he's
Marty.
The laborer.
He's been on the program a bunch.
He's a great guy. Joe Biden's the most pro-worker president. Look, when I called the White House and I talked to one of his aides and I said, you know, I think this campaign at Amazon in Bessemer, Alabama is really something. I mean, you've got basically a very young, overwhelmingly African-American workforce in the Deep South here, which is trying to organize with Amazon. You know, maybe the president should say something. The idea that within a month or so, he didn't just say something, he made a video.
Yep.
You know, and then he's done that over and over again. And I think that has made a
huge
difference.
Where was he in 2011? Where was Obama with the comfortable shoes when what was happening
Hello.
In Wisconsin?
Yeah.
You know, while I was sleeping on the granite floor there in Wisconsin while Scott Walker was pulling his nonsense.
Right.
We didn't hear anything. And this is, again,
when
I
we
come
got right
back
to freeload, as I call it, here in Michigan.
Absolutely.
We were marching around in Lansing. There was nobody coming in from D.C. to help us.
And this is why I think in this moment, to hear people like Sherrod Brown and Bob Casey, you know, saying the things that they were saying last night, Mary, the kind of things that you say, that has to be the message. We have to get away from all the other crazy stuff. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Representative Andy Levin here from Michigan. But, you know, this has got to be the message going forward, regardless of all the other stuff. This economic, between the curbs, kitchen table stuff.
Absolutely. I mean, how much can I make? Can I take care of my family? Can I get health care? You know, from my point of view, everybody should have, we should have, you know, Medicare for all. Everybody should have health care.
Perfect story. You know, my son, just before we started this tour, had his appendix burst.
Oh, my God. How is he?
He's doing really well now. Just got the tube taken out of his nose. He's so happy.
How old is he?
He's 16.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. It was
That's traumatic.
It was terrible. But you know, as I said on the program, the one thing that I did not worry about, didn't even think about until after everything was over, was how am I going to pay for it? I've got Teamster negotiated healthcare. I've got probably better healthcare than you've got.
I'm sure you.
I got my hip replaced. It cost me $120 out of pocket.
Let me tell you what.
I got good healthcare. I didn't, and the reason I bring this up, Congressman, is that I want everyone to have the kind of security that I have, knowing that I just want my son to be well. I want him to get the best care he can get and not have to worry about, am I going to go bankrupt, knowing that medical debt is the number one cause of bankruptcy in this country.
Number one
cause.
That
people lose their homes. They end up homeless because of medical debt. I don't want anyone to have that problem.
And I'm all for the Affordable Care Act, but despite all the tinkering, we still have millions and millions of people with no health insurance at all. And as you say, the amount of debt, medical debt, most that's all of it is people with insurance. It's because they have, you know, plans that don't pay for much, or they, you know, run out of coverage or whatever. I mean, the idea, I think people have a hard time even imagining what universal health care. The idea is that we would all collectively pay for health care, and then you wouldn't be picking doctors or pharmacies or long-term care facilities or any of that based on money. Money wouldn't have anything to do with it. It's the relationship between a doctor and a patient, a nurse and a patient, you know, a facility and a patient, a therapist and a patient. And it would all be just about taking care of people. We'd be a healthier society for sure. And there'd be a lot less of anxiety among working people.
Yeah, no, I say it all the time. I'm fortunate and I'm grateful for my union and what they've negotiated for me and my family in these moments, because I don't know how I would react if my first thought was, I can't afford this.
Yeah.
Other than going, I just want the best for my kid.
That's the only thing you should have to think about. All Americans should have to
think about. That's it. And to your point, we should have one giant insurance pool. I don't get this. Basic insurance, bigger the pool, lesser the risk.
Basic theory of it, right. And I mean, every other country manages to do it. Why can't we? It's just crazy.
It's crazy. So I want to bring it back to why you came down to Baker's Bar here in Hamtramck. And thank you for coming and visiting us here at the One Fair Wage event. Michigan's done some pretty interesting, some pretty good things on the One Fair Wage front, getting rid of the sub-minimum wage, haven't they?
Well,
I mean, that's coming.
It's not there yet. But, I mean, the situation is, look, the idea that we have these subminimum wages still, that people, that tipped workers make, $3, whatever, $4 an hour, and then they're supposed to make it up in tips. And then if they don't get enough tips, supposedly their employer fills the gap. Well, that's just a structure for wage theft. Right, because it's setting it up so that what if the employer shorts you? You're gonna, first of all, will you even know? Secondly, what are you gonna do? Who are you gonna go to? And anyway, the whole idea that people, 70% of tipped workers are women. What do you think they have to feel like when they, to get their tips? If some jerk is at the table treating them badly, it's wrong, and it's a vestige of Jim Crow anyway. Because that's where the whole idea of tipped workers comes from. And tipped workers are not only 70% women, they're way disproportionately of color. So we have fought super hard here to get rid of subminimum wages for tipped workers and to raise our minimum wage for all Michiganders up to $15 an hour or more. And we had a big petition drive. We're on the way. We're not quite there yet. It's not going to be on the ballot this year, but we're hoping to get it on the ballot soon. The main one thing that we really have to do is flip the state legislature. We're one of those states. There's a bunch of them that even though, like, we've had two U.S. senators who are Democrats forever.
Yep.
We've got a Democratic governor. All our statewide elected officials are Democrats. How come our state legislature is majority Republican in both the state Senate and the House, and and to some extent approaching supermajorities? It's gerrymandering the way it was. Well, we got rid of partisan gerrymandering. This year, we have a chance to have the state Senate and the state House become democratically controlled by the Democratic Party. And why that's especially important for this one fair wage thing, because we have this really weird provision in Michigan where if you work to get a ballot initiative on the ballot, a proposal, like we have this year, we're enshrining reproductive rights in our Constitution. We have three ballot proposals that made it this year. One is to make voting easier, then the reproductive rights one, and the third one is about changing term limits and so forth in the legislature and making government be more transparent. But here's the thing. Our state legislature can take a ballot proposal and pass it, and then change it. So we've had minimum wage increases in the past that the Republicans didn't want because it was too much. They adopted it to prevent the voters from passing it in November, and then they cut it in the legislature. It's the most undemocratic thing of all time. So
isn't that the point?
Is their point. Yeah. So we got to take back the legislature right now so we prevent that from happening. And then when next time around we can pass that initiative, and maybe the legislature itself could pass some good legislation to get rid of tip, subminimum wages.
And maybe we can actually get some things done for working people.
Absolutely.
So it's the last line I want to get into here,
yeah,
because we're in a moment coming into the election here. We're at a moment. We're kind of at a crossroads. I think the administration's doing some good things. I think you guys in Congress have done some good stuff. Talking about investing in our infrastructure, building roads and bridges and all that stuff, and broadband access in urban and rural communities.
Absolutely.
All great stuff. Reshoring manufacturing, investing in the future technologies, all incredible stuff. Talking about strengthening unions and doing that. Will that message resonate come November?
I certainly hope so. I got to add one little specific thing is that, we passed my legislation to allow our own staff in the House to form unions. And we passed it in May. Then in July, the workers in eight offices, including my own, filed for elections. My office was the very first to vote to unionize. They voted unanimously, 9-0, the people in the bargaining unit. It includes my district and my D.C. office, and We're now negotiating the first contract in the history of the 233-year history of the Congress. So even, you know, I'm trying to encourage all my wonderful colleagues to walk the walk, not just talk the talk. So I think all this is breaking through. I mean, I think time, you know, the party of the president who just won an election 2 years before is not supposed to do well in congressional elections. But I think several things are conspiring. Number one, those accomplishments you talked about. Democrats are delivering for working people right now. Number two, around here, the Republicans are putting up nutcase MAGA yahoos who don't even believe in democracy. You know, and that, you know, independent voters and moderate Republicans are not going to go for that. Democrats are certainly not going to go for that. But number three, I think people are sick of all this culture wars, that they just want us to get their paycheck big enough so they could survive. They want to have some breathing room. Yep. They want to be able to get childcare. They want to be, and you know, we're the party, we didn't get all of it done that we wanted to, Rick. We didn't get childcare, but we're the ones who tried. You know, we didn't get free community college, my bill passed, but the president wanted to. He wanted to get it done. So people's got to realize if they send some more Democrats to Washington and place capitals like Lansing, we can really deliver for the American people and create a new era of prosperity for working people in this
good
country.
Good stuff. Representative Levin, I appreciate you taking
thanks,
time for
Rick.
Us.
Thanks for being here.
Good stuff. Thanks, Andy. Appreciate it. Going to take a quick break right back here from Baker's Bar and Lounge here in Amtramck. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
This is the best of the Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1965. That was the day acclaimed photojournalist Dorothea Lange died. She is celebrated for her work documenting the Great Depression for the Farm Security Bureau. Lange's photos captured images of migrant workers, sharecroppers, and the rural poor. Her iconic photo, Migrant Mother, is probably her most well-known image. It depicts a despondent Dust Bowl mother surrounded by her hungry children. Lange was born in Hoboken, New Jersey in 1895. She suffered the effects of polio as a child, which left her with a permanent limp. She studied photography at Columbia University in New York and eventually settled in the Bay Area. When the Great Depression hit, she began photographing labor strikes, bread lines in soup kitchens, the homeless, and unemployed. The Resettlement Administration hired her soon after. Nowadays, we can access images from around the world at a moment's notice that broaden our understanding of current events. But until the 1930s, few Americans could access media that adequately depicted the desperate social conditions engulfing the nation. Federal programs that funded projects like Lange's brought Depression-era images into the public eye. Americans soon realized their suffering wasn't caused by personal failure, that millions across the country were experiencing destitution brought on by broader economic forces. During World War II, Lange worked for the War Relocation Authority, where she documented forced evacuation and internment of Japanese Americans. Her images, especially of Manzanar, were withheld from the public until after the war and were accessible to the public through the National Archives. After the war, she taught at San Francisco's Art Institute and co-founded the magazine Aperture. She has been heralded as an innovator and has influenced generations of documentary photography. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Last year's gubernatorial race in Virginia was narrowly won by Republican Glenn Youngkin. An elite Wall Street multimillionaire, he was going to lose until he discovered a right-wing racist bugaboo called critical race theory. Glenn suddenly turned into an anti-CRT attack dog, fomenting parental fear and promising to sweep all teaching of the theory out of Virginia's classrooms. But golly, CRT was not actually being taught in any of the state's public schools. To help Youngkin dodge this inconvenient fact, a partisan front group called Metric Media created 25 fake news sites in Virginia that ran nearly 5,000 articles during the election, spreading the CRT bugaboo. While these papers have no subscribers and no significant readership, they allowed demagogues like Youngkin to use such lies in speeches, ads, etc., laundering them as facts by simply saying, as reported in the such-and-such newspaper. With success in Virginia, Metric Media and other fake sites are pumping out CRT sludge in Florida, Texas, and other states with gubernatorial races this year. Indeed, the lie has become its own political industry, with such billionaire extremists as the Koch brothers pumping money into it. This is why America must have actual local newspapers, widely available and affordable either in print or online, that have the community commitment and journalistic resources to do the job of nurturing truth and democracy. Otherwise, we're ceding news to the shams and scams that are inevitable under hedge fund profiteers and networks of partisan hacks that already dominate wide swaths of America's media landscape. This is Jim Hightower saying, journalism is key to democratic self-government, and we should start investing in it, providing public funding for local independent watchdog reporting.
You're listening to the best of The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, looking forward to going into the state of Michigan, into Detroit, and, you know, some of our friends there, and I've got lots of friends in Detroit, and a lot of my Teamster buddies, looking forward to seeing them, but also looking forward to the event that we're putting together, and I think this is going to be fun and entertaining and, well, helpful with our good friends with One Fair Wage as we talk about, you know, making work pay. Reward for work, dignity of work, respect for work, you know, all those frames that we like to talk about. And here to share some thoughts on, well, that concept and maybe the event that we're going to put together there in Detroit on October 7th. I've asked Saruya Raman to come talk with us. She's the president of One Fair Wage, their website, onefairwage.com. Saru, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me.
So, you know, this idea of, you know, reward for work, this idea that if you work hard, you play by the rules, that you should actually get ahead, kind of the point of this whole tour that we're throwing together. No matter which hat you wore, the red hat, the blue hat, it's all about making sure that the wages, hours, conditions that we work for, fair.
That's right. And what's so exciting about this moment that you're doing this tour is that for the first time really in our industry, restaurant industry, since emancipation, really, workers are rising up across the country and refusing to work for the poverty wages that they've agreed to work for generations. We've talked before on your show about this history that at emancipation, the restaurant industry basically wanted the ability to hire newly freed slaves, not pay them, let them live on tips. That is the origin of the ridiculously low subminimum wage for tipped workers, which is $2 at the federal level, $3 in Michigan, $4 in Ohio, $6 in Illinois. It's an absurd and ridiculous subminimum wage. Doesn't exist everywhere, only in 43 states. Seven states got rid of it. But even in these 43 states with a subminimum wage, what's so exciting is that literally millions of workers are walking out the door, refusing to work for these subminimum wages, saying, I won't come back unless you pay me a full wage. And we're seeing wages go up for the first time ever. We're seeing restaurants that used to pay $3 and $4 now paying $25 an hour plus tips. It's a really incredible historic moment.
And interestingly enough, they're still doing just fine. Thank you very much.
That's right. We've been at this trying to pass policy for decades to end the subminimum wage for tipped workers and raise the overall minimum wage. And there's been this, you know, very big obstacle in our way. The National Restaurant Association, we call it the other NRA, led by the chains, the Applebee's, the IHOPs. They've been fighting us as a very powerful bully for decades. But they've been much more mute in the last 9 months than we've ever seen them, because Applebee's and IHOP need staff too. They need staff too. And they're telling workers, come work for us, we'll pay you more. So they can't fight us in the public arena the way they used to. And we're finally winning. And we just had a big victory in Michigan, and we're about to have a lot more.
No, and let's talk about Michigan, because Michigan, you know, when I grew up as a kid in the 70s, Michigan was an economic powerhouse, as the Midwest was. You know, growing up in Cleveland, it was all about steel and auto. Michigan was all about auto. Detroit was, you know, the Motor City. And now we've moved from a productive economy that built automobiles and factories that built products to a service-based economy. And we pine for those jobs. And part of the, what we're finding on this tour is people are going, look, we want those factory jobs back. But what they really want is they want those union wages back.
That's right.
Because
that's
they
right.
forget that those factory jobs were crummy jobs before
that's
they
right.
were union jobs.
They were, in fact, the original sweatshops, right? And now we like to say the restaurant is the new sweatshop. You know, when you're paid $3 an hour, I don't know what else you call it, you know, except a sweatshop. You're overworked and underpaid. And you're right. That was the situation for garment workers and union workers 100 years ago. And they organized and they unionized and they got themselves a higher wage. And now here we are as restaurant workers, I think finally, for the first time ever, demanding the same. So I am hopeful. As bad as it's been with the $3 and $4 wages, I am very hopeful that change is coming. Not just individual restaurants and individual businesses raising wages, but policy is about to change. You know, Michigan, something really incredible just happened in Michigan. So back in 2018, we collected 400,000 signatures to put this issue on the ballot to raise the minimum wage to $12 an hour and end the subminimum wage for tipped workers, still $3.67 in Michigan. Well, at that time, the Republicans who control the legislature said, we don't want this to drive working people to the polls. So they announced to the press, we're taking this off the ballot. We're going to make it the law. Republicans quadrupled the wages of waitresses in Michigan. But we promised to gut this after the election because we're only doing it to keep people from going to vote themselves a raise. So they went ahead, they raised the wage, and then they turned it back down to $3. And just in the most cruel irony, a year later, those $3 workers who went up to 12 and back down to 3, they were told by the state of Michigan, same state of Michigan, that their wages were too low to qualify for unemployment insurance when they lost their jobs in the pandemic. So, you know, the fact that they are now saying enough is enough, tips have gone way down, harassment is up, I'm just not going to put up with it anymore. All of that happened over the last year. And in July, Michigan Court of Claims ruled that what the Republicans did back in 2018 was unconstitutional. And therefore, the original law that Republicans passed to suppress the vote is now the law of the of Michigan. Michigan has just become the 8th state to end the subminimum wage for tipped workers, and the wage has gone up to 12. We've already collected enough signatures for it to go to 15 and 24. So it just keeps getting better, and Michigan is leading the way. There are a lot of other states about to follow. D.C. and Portland, Maine are on the ballot this November. In Illinois, we've got legislation moving. In California, wages are going up, and we're fighting to end the subminimum wage for incarcerated workers in California. Things are happening all over the country, and it's really, I'm so proud that Michigan is leading on this issue and kicking it off.
Why haven't I heard the Republicans, you know, leading with this, saying that they're the ones who are raising? Why haven't I heard this? I mean, this sounds like something that should be, you know, their pivot to getting working people on their side. Because, look,
oh
I
God.
Say all the time Republicans hate working people, but
oh
you're telling
God.
Me they raise the wage.
They raise the wage. I mean, it's really not just Republicans. Like, wages have been going up under a Democratic administration. And we've been trying to get Democrats to stand with these issues as well. It's been really, really tough. And I think, listen, this is the thing. We find when we're out there collecting signatures in Michigan, in Ohio, wherever we are, people of all political persuasions agree with us. If we go up to somebody and say, will you sign a petition for 15? They say, whoa, I already signed it. Or where can I sign? There's been almost nobody who opposes this among working people in Michigan and Ohio and other states around the country. It's our elected officials of both parties who somehow think of raising wages as a supposedly controversial issue, and it's like the least controversial, most popular issue that exists. And it's because they all are stuck in this echo chamber with the Restaurant Association, somehow believing that we can't raise wages because it will hurt our friends in the Restaurant Association. Now we've got thousands of restaurant owners who are coming out with us saying, listen, we're raising wages. We need it to be a level playing field. We need everybody to go up because we can't get these workers to come back unless we do.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with Saru Yaraman. She's the president of One Fair Wage. OneFairWage.com, their website, if you want to check out the work that they do, and I highly suggest that you do. Now, you know, it's interesting that you point out that both parties kind of not on board with this. This is where I come back to the premise of this tour, where if we're going to unite this country,
This is where we do it. I mean, you know, everyone's bought the red hat or the blue hat, and we've picked our teams, and we've got our shirts, and some have flags and all this stuff. But wages, hours, conditions, that ideal that if we work hard, play by the rules, get ahead. These are the things that I think can, should, and must bring us back together.
Totally. I couldn't agree with you more. I've really been out there trying. I mean, let me just share one example of Michigan. I have my own biases. I live in California. I'm a brown woman. And I went out to do petition gathering in Western Michigan, which is more red. And I brought with me three women of color, all Muslim, in hijab. And we walked up to people in malls and on the street asking them to sign a petition for 15. And we were all pretty scared. You know, it's a pretty white part of Michigan, pretty conservative, older people. And people said, again, where can I sign? Of course I agree with this. A cost of a gallon of gas in Michigan is $5, and you're telling me the wage is $3.67. We had older people tell me, wait a second, that's what I earned 40 years ago. What are you talking about? You know, there was such universal agreement. And I happened to be there, Rick, the week of the shooting in the school in Uvalde, Texas. And it was so painful because once again, you hear this ridiculously, you know, partisan conversation about, you know, what it's so controversial. What can we do? But being there, talking to people, knowing that we are not polarized from each other. We are actually polarized in some cases from our elected officials who don't understand how popular and united we are around the need to just be able to survive and feed your family.
And this is why I keep saying that, you know, whichever party, and I'm hoping the Democrats take this on and make working class issues the center of their platform and really hammer on this. And look, I think Joe Biden has done a fairly good job. I think he's done a good job of moving towards, you know, reinvesting in infrastructure, spending some money on reshoring manufacturing, and talking about workers joining and forming unions to share in the wealth that their labor creates. I think this is moving us back in a positive direction, but we need the policy. We need the legislation and the signature on the dotted line to move this stuff forward.
Absolutely. We need elected officials to understand how popular this is, come out, and also understand this isn't just popular, it drives people to vote who never vote. You know, people feel really disengaged with both parties and candidates, but the opportunity to go vote yourself a raise is the most incredible opportunity of all. So I do want to say, since we're coming up on an election, that part of what we're doing in Michigan and this event that you're coming to in Detroit is all about workers actually telling each other, listen, we just want a raise in the courts. The courts just declared we're going to get a raise to $12 an hour, but we've actually got to go vote for people who are going to enforce it.
Yep.
And I will say, in Michigan, Republicans are not going to enforce this law. If they get into the governorship, if they get the attorney general, they are not going to enforce this law. They never intended for this law to pass. And so there's a very clear choice if we want to see this raise this November in Michigan, what we need to do as working people. But it's not just voting. It's then holding our people accountable, our own people accountable, to actually enforce that race.
Now, I do want to thank you for making me feel really, really old by pointing out that it was more than 35 years ago that I was making $3.35 an hour, which was the minimum wage when I was in high school back 35, 38 years ago. Thanks for that. But here's the thing, and this is the important part. I don't think most people understand that this is the law. And I know where I live in Pennsylvania, the minimum wage is like for tipped workers in this state is less than $3 an hour.
$2.83. It's ridiculous. It's outrageous in 2022. I mean, that is literally half the cost of a gallon of gas. Who is going to go to work when your wage is half the cost? You're not going to pay double to get to work than you get when you get there. You're not going to do it. So give me a break.
There you go. So last line of question I've got for you, because as you said, there are campaigns going on in Ohio, in Maine, and in other places. What's the pitch for folks in those areas? What can people do to help? Because I know working people want to help other working people, because the idea that when we all do better, we all do better. So how do we help?
please, everybody, thank you so much for asking. Everybody go to onefairwage.org, onefairwage.org. You can sign up to get involved. You can send an email to info@onefairwage.org. You can join us to collect signatures or to talk to voters this November in Michigan. We're going to be collecting signatures in Ohio on Election Day for the $15 minimum wage. And, you know, in Illinois, tell your legislators to end the subminimum wage for tipped workers. In California, tell your legislators end the subminimum wage for incarcerated workers. And tell you everybody who lives in D.C. and Portland, Maine, to vote yes on One Fair Wage in their cities.
There's an awful lot to get to, so I'm sure go to onefairwage.org, and all of that information will be there. And if you want to sign up, I'm sure there are newsletters and ways to participate and help. Onefairwage.org, right?
That's right. Thank you so much, Rick.
Good stuff. I look forward to seeing you in Detroit on the 7th and Cleveland on the 31st of October. All good stuff. Thanks so much, Saru.
Thank you, Rick.
Appreciate the time, Saru Yaraman, president of One Fair Wage. Again, onefairwage.org, their website. I want to hear your thoughts. Are you against the idea of raising the tipped minimum wage? Because, you know, that $2.83 an hour here in Pennsylvania, and it doesn't go that far. It's criminal in my view, but I'd love to hear yours. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Follow us at thericksmithshow.com. And also, don't forget, grab the podcast. Never miss a moment from our tour. Back after this. You're listening to the best of The Rick Smith Show. We will be returning on January 3rd. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1874. That was the day that Mary Heaton Vorse was born in New York City. Mary grew up in Amherst, Massachusetts, in a family with significant financial means. She traveled across Europe with her parents, where she received her education and learned to speak multiple languages fluently. She then worked as a book reviewer for the Criterion magazine. In 1912, Mary and the man who would be her husband witnessed what would be known as the Bread and Roses textile strike in Lawrence, Massachusetts. The experience was a great turning point in her life. She later wrote, "Both Joe O'Brien and I had come a long road to get to Lawrence. Together, we experienced the realization of the human cost of our industrial life. Something transforming happened to both of us. We knew now where we belonged. On the side of the workers and not with the comfortable people among whom we were born. Some synthesis had taken place between my life and that of the workers. Some peculiar change that would never again permit me to look with indifference on the fact that riches for the few were made by misery of the many. It was in Lawrence that we realized what we must do, that we could make one contribution, that of writing the workers' story as long as we lived." For more than 50 years after Lawrence, Mary traveled the United States reporting and participating in strikes and the labor movement. She wrote about the 1919 steel strike and the lumber workers' strike in the Pacific Northwest. She wrote about the struggles of auto workers and textile workers and child labor. In 1962, the United Auto Workers honored Mary with their Social Justice Award. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
You're listening to the best of The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to Baker's Bar here in Hamtramck, Michigan, as we wrap up our day here of talking to low-wage workers, to our friends at One Fair Wage. And remember, check out their website, onefairwage.org. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at that. You know, I always like having Saru Yaraman on the program talking about, she's kind of the conscience of the workforce. She's the one who really articulates the struggles of workers at the bottom of the economic scale, the people who take care of us, clean up after us, feed us, do all of the things that maybe we don't notice enough of or take for granted. And I'm sitting here with the executive producer, the professor, my roadmate, Brett Pransky. Brett, thanks for being here.
Hey, happy to be here.
So what'd you think of Saru? I mean, I see her as the conscience of the economy, someone who's pointing out, you know, just how ridiculous it is that we pay these kind of poverty wages to people and then expect them to be, you know, courteous and happy and joyful and cheery. It seems kind of ludicrous to me.
Yeah, it really does. I mean, as I listen to her, what she has to say, how she articulates the argument, the only thing I can really, that really comes to mind is I wouldn't want to be the guy being paid by the restaurant industry to sit on the other side of that debate. Because it's a loser. I mean, she's just so good at articulating the message that you know, if it's loud enough and if enough people hear it, I believe things will change.
Now I go back to this, and I've heard this argument before, and we talked about it a little bit today. The argument is we'd love to raise the minimum wage. We'd love to treat these workers with dignity and respect. We'd love them to earn a living wage. But you know what? We just can't afford it. You know, prices would go up and nobody would go out to eat anymore. And the industry would just die. And I think we're at a moment where the industry is kind of dying because, well, you're not paying people a living wage. And we're seeing workers, when they have other options, are choosing better paying options. So, to me, getting rid of the sub-minimum wage, starting to talk about what is a reasonable wage for people who do this kind of work, this is how we save that industry, because we all like to eat out. We all like people to clean our hotel rooms and do the work that we don't want to do. But I think most of us want to make sure that they can lead a good life.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that if the wages came up, there would be any real issue in terms of, people going to these places and or being willing to pay these wages. I mean, it's just not a real thing. It's something that the industry, puts out there and puts a lot of money behind in order to kind of scare people into maintaining the status quo.
Yeah, what I love that argument. Well, if you're going to pay them, $7 an hour, why not just pay them $50 an hour or pay them $100? I mean, you've heard these ridiculous arguments. Oh, just pay them this. And I'm going, that's not what's being said here. Shut up and listen. And because right. Nobody's advocating to make a cheeseburger $40. Nobody's, because other, this is the weird thing. And this is the part that I'm struggling with those arguments. Other countries seem to have figured this out. In other countries, minimum, fast food workers make like 16, 20 bucks an hour with benefits, with vacation, with days off, with sick time, with things that, well, our fast food workers only could at this moment dream about.
Right. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that, a lot of these other countries have a greater sense of community than we do. There's a better sense of us. I mean, we've been talking a lot on this trip about the jobs that went away, like the jobs that were shipped overseas, the people who lost the industrial jobs and things like that. Well, and this is kind of an incomplete metaphor, but it does kind of demonstrate the point. If you and I and our neighbors and everyone down the street was willing to pay an extra quarter for tube socks, a lot of those jobs wouldn't have gone away. So, being willing to handle a small price increase in order to make sure that your neighbor still has a job and your neighborhood still has good schools and things like, all of this feeds into the system. So the idea that there is a we out there, we should care about that we, including these people that we have just been dismissing for a very long time. I mean, yep. It's something we really just need to get away from it.
That's an excellent point. Now, tomorrow on the program, we're going to be in Flint, Michigan, going to the farmers market in Flint, Michigan, to sit down with Attorney General Dana Nessel, also going to talk to some folks there and get a sense of what Flint is. Now, real quick, my thought is, what I'm expecting we're going to see in Flint is what the media has framed for us. It's a city on decline. It's basically a hellhole, is what I've been told. It's what's been pitched to me, and I'm kind of interested to find out what I'm going to see, because that frame hasn't played out in the places we've been thus far.
Yeah, I mean, national media, whenever the city name of Flint comes up, all we hear about is, oh, the Flint water crisis and all the terrible things. And I'm sure we're going to run into things that are not ideal. We're going to see that the town has issues, the city has issues, because every city does. But I have a feeling that what we're going to find there is a vibrant community. And I'll bet you anything, what we're going to find is it's a community that is doing better now than it was even 2 or 3 years ago. That people are going to talk about, you know, not only the things that have happened that have been bad in the past, but the things that are happening now that are trending in the right direction. Now, it's a guess, but I think that's what we're going to run into.
No, and look, we're here in Hamtramck, you know, this beautiful little place, and coming back is the theme that I keep getting from people. You know, we're on the upswing. Things are getting better. There's investments being made. In fact, the one person said, you know, when he grew up, the rents were like $200. They're now like $1,200. If that's a barometer of an area getting better, you know, there are people on the streets. There's activity in the streets in a positive way. And I think that's so far, this is what we've found, that while all the messaging is all negative, the economy's bad, it's terrible, you know, the country's on fire. I'm not finding that with the people we're talking to.
No, neither am I. I mean, we're seeing an arc. We're seeing an arc through history. There was a time, you know, when you know, industry and manufacturing, all these things were here and they were good. And then, you know, there was a time when a lot of that stuff went away and things got pretty bad for a while. And then, you know, recently the story of now is kind of that we're moving into a better place, but it's a matter of, you know, we're one election, you know, or at least, you know, one or maybe two elections away from stopping all that progress and going in exactly the opposite direction. So I think it's really pivotal that everyone gets out and votes.
I can't reiterate that enough. But the reality is we've had a great time thus far on the Working Class Heroes Radio Tour. And I want to thank our friends at the...
You're listening to The Shaw. WAUK 540 AM Jackson. W266 DR Waukesha. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.